Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the bird flu epidemic story when we come back. You know, the income tax and Social Security programs are not compatible with our traditional American values, and that's because these two programs encompass the second and the eighth planks to the Communist Manifesto. It's a foreign and alien ideology. Traditional American values are individual responsibility in place of Social Security and tithing in place of the income tax. These foreign and alien ideologies require of us that we violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant. We covet our neighbor's property, and we call that income redistribution. We steal from our neighbors with unjust weights and measures. We call those Federal Reserve notes. And then we practice idolatry by signing contracts with these foreign and alien gods that we call government. And we don't get away with these crimes either. We pay up to 75% of everything that we create and produce in taxes. We live in mortgaged homes owned by the savings and loan companies. We drive cars owned by GMAC or Ford Motor Finance. The average family of four has a $70,000 consumer debt. We owe a $8 trillion national debt. We're surety for another $43 trillion of unfunded government obligations. Our financial institutions are leveraged out to $60 trillion worldwide, and our Social Security retirement system is a chain letter Ponzi scheme. We live from paycheck to paycheck, and then we're taught to call all of this prosperity. Now, the God of Israel gave us a better way than that, and our founding fathers followed that better way of life. And now, if you'd like to learn more about tax and status and a better way of life, why don't you call and order my free 4-hour compact disc package? It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. You can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, you know, I have said over the years that if you can't solve a problem, or if you don't know what the solution to the problem is, then you don't need to talk about it. The flu problem has a solution. I don't know why we're being propagandized and sold this flu epidemic, but we are, and we'll buy it. America will be a buyer, a net consumer of this new bird flu. What that's going to do to the nation, what that's going to do to the world, or the world's economies, or the world's population, I don't know. I have some clues, I have some ideas, but I'm just like everybody else. God does not talk to me. I don't know any more about it than I read in the papers or read in the Bible, or what I've picked up from history, or what I've observed from my own common sense. But in reading this article from Foreign Affairs magazine that we've been covering for the last two or three programs, called The Next Pandemic. You can get a copy of it by simply going to www.foreignaffairs.org. It's must reading. It's called The Next Pandemic by Lori Garrett. Foreign Affairs, it's the July-August 2005 edition. www.foreignaffairs.org. We downloaded it from the computer. You can do the same thing. Now, in conclusion, they point out that probably the greatest weakness that each and every nation must individually address is the inability of their hospitals to cope with a sudden surge of new patients. Medical cost cutting has resulted in a tremendous reduction in the numbers of staffed hospital beds in the wealthy world, especially in the United States. Even during a normal flu season, hospitals located in popular retirement areas have great difficulty meeting the demand. In a pandemic, it is doubtful that any nation would have adequate medical facilities and personnel to meet this extra need. National policymakers would be wise to plan now for worst-case scenarios involving quarantines, weakened armed services, and dwindling hospital space and vaccine supplies. But at the end of the day, effectively combating influenza will require multilateral and global mechanisms. Chief among them, of course, is the World Health Organization, which since 1947 has maintained a worldwide network that conducts influenza surveillance. The World Health Organization system oversees laboratories all over the world, chases and sometimes refutes rumors of pandemics, pushes for government transparency regarding human and avian flu cases, and it acts as an arbiter in negotiations over vaccine production, trade embargoes, and border disputes. Its companion, United Nations Agency, the Food and Agriculture Organization called the FAO, working closely with the World Organization for Animal Health, monitors flu outbreaks in animal populations and advises governments on culling flocks and herds, cross-border animal trade, animal husbandry, and the slaughter, and to respond to pandemic flu, lists of answers to commonly asked questions, and descriptions of their research priorities, most of which have been posted on their websites. Now, the efforts of these agencies should be bolstered both with expertise and with dollars. The World Health Organization, for example, has an annual core budget of just $400 million, a tiny increment of which is spent on influenza and epidemic response programs. In comparison, the annual budget of New York City's health department exceeds $1.2 billion. An unpublished internal study estimates that the agency would require at least another $600 million for its flu program were a pandemic to erupt. It is in every government's interest to give the World Health Organization and the Food and Agriculture Organization the authority to act as impartial voices during a pandemic, able, theoretically at least, to assess objectively the epidemic's progress and rapidly evaluate research claims. The World Health Organization, in particular, must have adequate funding and personnel to serve as an accurate clearinghouse of information about the disease, thereby preventing the spread of false rumors and global panic. No nation can erect a fortress against influenza, not even the world's wealthiest country. Now, few members of the U.S. Congress or its legislative counterparts around the world were alive when the great Spanish flu swept the planet. There may be some who lost parents, aunts, or uncles to the 1918-1919 pandemic, and perhaps even more have heard the horror stories that were passed down. But politics breeds short-sightedness, and for decades the threat of an influenza pandemic has been easily forgotten, and therefore it has been ignored at budget time. Politicians and health leaders made many serious errors in the 1918-1919 period, and some historians say that President Wilson sent 43,000 American soldiers to their deaths by forcing them aboard crowded ships to join a war that he had already won. But in those days, human beings had no understanding of their influenza foe. In 1971, the great American public health leader, Alexander Langmuir, likened flu forecasting to trying to predict the weather, arguing that as with hurricanes, pandemics can be identified and their probable course projected so that warnings can be issued. Epidemics, however, are more variable than hurricanes, and the best that can be done is to estimate probabilities. Since Langmuir's time, a quarter of a century ago, weather forecasting has gained a stunning level of precision. And although scientists cannot tell political leaders when an influenza pandemic is going to occur, researchers today are able to guide policymakers with information and analysis exponentially richer than that which informed the decisions of President Ford and the 1976 Congress. Whether or not this particular H5N1 influenza mutates into a human-to-human pandemic form, the scientific evidence points to the potential that just such an event will in fact take place, perhaps very soon. Those responsible for foreign policy and national security the world over cannot afford to ignore this warning. In effect, the article tells us all of the details that we need to know as to what the problem of flu is, and in the last three or four pages tells us, but there's no human solution. That's the bottom line. Now, if you want to rely upon the health care system, FEMA, and your government, you do so at your own peril. You saw how inefficient government is in dealing with hurricanes. You can see how cost-effective government is in the educational system, where it takes $7,000 to educate a child in public school, only $546 to educate that same child in a home school, and only $2,500 to educate that child in a public school. One-third the amount of money, and you can send your kid to a private school. And furthermore, the educational outcome will be better if you educate them at home or better if you educate them in a private school. You have the poorest performing students coming out of public schools with the highest amount of money worldwide per capita being spent upon them. And we call that public school. There isn't anything that government cannot do half as well for twice as much. Now, there is a solution, and it's been around for thousands of years. It's just now being discovered by modern medical science. It would actually be used by modern medical science except for politics and money. It's called silver. Silver is a medicine. It's a medicine that we get from the Bible. We get it from God. We get it from Moses. And that's why we can't use it. Anything that comes from God, we don't want to touch. If it comes from man or government or some false god, some form of snake venom, mouse milk, or monkey pus, we can't wait to mainline it. We shoot it right into our veins like we invented the stuff. Now it's silver that is finding wholly new uses as a wonder in modern medicine. Thanks to eye-opening research, silver is emerging as a wonder of modern medicine. It's an antibiotic. It kills perhaps a half dozen different disease organisms. But silver kills some 650 resistant strains and fails to develop. Moreover, silver is virtually non-toxic, says a pioneering silver researcher, Dr. Harry Margrat, I believe it's Margrat, of St. Louis. Silver is the best all-around germ fighter that we have. I know, sounds kind of wild, but stand by and listen up. Developed by Dr. Charles Fox of Columbia University, a silver compound known as silver sulfatazine is used in 70% of burn centers in the United States today. It also stops the herpes virus responsible for cold sores and fever blisters. With silver sulfoxidine, Dr. Fox scored what properly is acclaimed as a momentous breakthrough because it was the first new silver compound to win FDA approval and become generally available. A pharmaceutical house, Marion Laboratories, is offering it as an ointment under the brand name of Silvadine. Other companies are making silver sulfate zinc. See if I can say that again. Sulfadazine, available in several countries from Canada to India. Doctors are reporting that, taken internally, the compound works against three scourges: syphilis, cholera, and malaria. And even tiny amounts of silver wipe out huge quantities of disease organisms in water, and some specific instances of silver's use are: 1. To guard against such waterborne diseases as dysentery, more than half the world's airlines now use silver water filters. For instance, British Airways, Swiss Air, Scandinavian Airlines, Lufthansa, Olympic, Air France, Canadian Pacific, Alitalia, KLM, Japan Airlines, and Pan American. The Swiss government has approved silver water filters, and they're used in homes and offices throughout the country. After testing 23 methods of purifying water, NASA selected a silver system for the space shuttle. Silver is widely used to purify swimming pool water, and it doesn't sting your eyes as chlorine does. A dramatic demonstration recently took place in Nebraska. 50 gallons of sewage was pumped into a pool without any disinfectant. A standard measure of contamination is the count of E. coli, an organism found in the human intestinal tract. The count soared to 7,000 E. coli cells per milliliters of water. Then, the water was flushed through silver electrodes, and within 3 hours, it was completely free of E. coli bacteria contamination. Silver also can fight deadly poisons. Japanese firms have announced 5 startling technologies which use silver to purify air. One company converts 50 parts per million of carbon monoxide to harmless carbon dioxide by passing the gas through a stack of screens coated with silver compounds. Another use of silver compounds is to remove vinyl cyanide, methyl cyanide, and hydrocyanic acid from its discharges. A gas chemicals company removes all the 200 parts per million of nitric oxide by passing the gas through its silver compounds. The currently increasing medical interest in silver actually reflects a kind of revival in the public health sector. In ancient Greece and Rome, people used silver containers to keep liquids fresh. American settlers traveling across the West often put a silver dollar into their milk jugs or cans to delay its spoiling. Around the turn of the century, some doctors used silver nitrate to help the healing of stomach ulcers. And yet silver fell out of favor. The reason was argyria, a skin discoloration that results when hundreds of times the proper amount of silver compounds are injected or taken orally. Silver becomes deposited under the skin and stays there. It's harmless. In fact, silver kills bacteria that may be present, but of course nobody wants gray skin. So for a while then, only 2 medical uses for silver continued. Dentists use it to fill teeth with a silver alloy, and doctors put a few drops of a 1% silver nitrate solution in newborn babies' eyes to kill bacteria that can cause blindness. The comeback of silver in medicine began more than a decade ago. The late Dr. Carl Moyer, the chairman of Washington University's Department of Surgery, received a grant to develop better treatments for burn victims. Dr. Margraf, as the chief biochemist, worked with Dr. Moyer and other surgeons to find an antiseptic strong yet safe to use over large areas of the human body. Dr. Margraf reviewed 22 antiseptic compounds and found drawbacks in all of them. Mercury, for example, is an excellent antiseptic, but it is extremely toxic. Popular antiseptics such as mercurochrome and merthiolate can be used over small areas only. Many iodine compounds are effective, but quite a few people are allergic to iodine. Since the doctor rarely knows if a patient is allergic, it's prudent to rely on something else. Dilute alcoholic solutions, hydrogen peroxide, and other antiseptics can be used on little cuts, but they're too painful on big wounds. Disease organisms can become resistant to antibiotics, triggering a dangerous superinfection. And antibiotics are totally ineffective in dealing with viruses. These compounds are also ineffective against a number of harmful bacteria, including the biggest killer in burn cases, which is a bluish-green bacteria called Pseudomonas aeruginosa. It almost always shows up in burns releasing a toxic poison. Reviewing medical literature, Dr. Margraf found repeated references to silver. It's described as a catalyst that disables the enzymes microorganisms depend on to breathe. Consequently, they die. When Dr. Margraf began his research, the best-known compound was silver nitrate because it's the simplest silver compound that dissolves in water. Pure silver will not dissolve. But though silver nitrate kills microorganisms, it can also be corrosive and painful. Dr. Margraf noted that it had been used in relatively high concentrations. So, what would happen, he wondered, with more dilute solutions? The researchers began testing and after several months settled on a 5.5% solution. It killed the Pseudomonas aeruginosa and permitted wounds to heal. Resistant strains did not appear. Silver nitrate, however, was far from ideal, reports Dr. Margraf. It severely disturbs the balance of body salts, and its use must be halted from time to time. It must be applied in thick, cumbersome dressings and stains everything that it touches. So he tested 53 other silver compounds, some of which were newly synthesized, the most promising, a complex silver-zinc allantoinate, and it proved to be as effective with chronic skin ulcers as with burns. In the publication, Archives of Surgery, published by the American Medical Association, Dr. Margraf now reports his latest findings. Silver zinc allantoinate helped 339 of 400 chronic skin ulcers heal. On an average, bacterial counts dropped 99% within 1 week. Many diabetics were saved from needless amputation. The compound now is undergoing tests by Miles Laboratories. Meanwhile, at Columbia, Dr. Fox, who had been studying the germ-fighting properties of silver for 9 years, tested nearly 100 different compounds before settling on silver sulfatazine. Though it contains sulfa, he reports, the silver keeps this compound from acting like a sulfenamide. Resistance hasn't been a problem. Richard L. Davies, Executive Director of the Silver Institute, which monitors silver technology in 37 countries, reports that in 4 years we've described 87 important new medical uses for silver, and we're just beginning to see to what extent silver can relieve suffering and save lives. You can rest assured that in the influenza attack, there will be no silver made available to anyone for any cause or reason. Let me give you a little short here, some testimonials. Thought I was going to give you a testimonial. Here it is. A speeding car overturned and burst into flames. The 18-year-old driver suffered burns all over his face, neck, arms, hands, back, stomach, and legs. Burns covered more than 80% of his body. Now, until recently, this would have been a death sentence. Doctors knew how to restore vital body fluids and salts, but they had no way to fight infection. Infection is the primary cause of death in burn cases. Fortunately for this youth, a new silver compound killed deadly bacteria and enabled him to heal. He was out of the hospital in about 4 months. A 65-year-old diabetic cut himself on the leg. He washed and bandaged the wound, but as often happens with diabetics, the pain persisted and the cut grew into a sore. Soon, it became bigger than the bandage, and he had to apply a dressing. Still, it grew bigger and uglier. In desperation, he went to a clinic. His sore was diagnosed as a stasis ulcer. For a year, one treatment after another was tried. Nothing, including penicillin and sulfenamide, could heal the ulcer. If his condition had continued unchecked, his leg most assuredly would have been amputated. But finally he was referred to a clinic that treated skin ulcers with a new silver compound. The silver compound promptly stopped growth of all of the bacteria, and in less than 2 months the ulcer was completely healed. Now, I mentioned to you the last time, or time before, that colloidal silver you can make in your own home. Now, this guy here made reference to the fact you could throw a silver dollar into a pot of milk and it will kill the bacteria and delay the spoilage. You won't eliminate it, but it'll delay it. Milk goes sour because the bacteria increases in the milk. About every 20 minutes it doubles. As a result of that bacteria growth, the milk sours. Now, silver is the only antiseptic that we know of that kills, on contact, viruses. The Roche Company, with their Tamiflu, says it kills many of the viruses, but not all. And in some cases, it's effective, and in some other cases, it is not effective. Silver is always effective because it kills on contact and it's non-toxic and you can take it into your body without any side effects. Drugs don't work that way. Drugs all have some kind of a side effect. Now, there is an outfit here called Silver Lawn. I'm going to give you their address. Silver Lawn, S-I-L-V-E-R-L-O-M. Put out by the Argentum, A-R-G-E-N-T-U-M, Argentum Research Incorporated, Post Office Box 429. They're located at 36 Lake Rabun Road, spelled R-A-B-U-N Road, Lake Mont, Georgia, 30552. The telephone number is 706-782-6700. Again, that's Argentum Research Incorporated, Post Office Box 429, 36 Lake Rabun Road, Lakemont, Georgia, 30552. Their phone number, 706-782-6700. Their webpage is www.silverlawn.com, spelled SILVERLON.com. It's a new standard for the next millennium, they say. Antimicrobial barrier protection, natural, no known adverse reactions, kills all known bacteria and fungi that infect wounds, less scarring, enhanced healing, and pain reduction. Now, the inventor's story goes like this. While attending medical school at the State University of New York in Syracuse, New York, I had the opportunity to observe the first human clinical trial of Silverlawn at the VA hospital under the leadership of Dr. Robert Becker. And I was able to witness firsthand the near miraculous healing power of Silverlawn. That's a registered trademark, by the way, Silverlawn, in complex clinical cases that had failed to heal by conventional techniques. So as a resident in orthopedic surgery at the University of Vermont, permission was obtained from the Human Experimentation Committee to apply Silverlawn to a patient with a serious bone infection and soft tissue loss. With the application of Silverlawn, the patient's leg was saved, and I became a believer in Silverlawn. Over the past 15 years, I have applied Silverlawn to over 300 patients that I have seen in my own private practice with continued excellent results. The cases have covered a broad range of wound types, from disubitus ulcers, stage 1 to stage 4, partial and full thickness thermal injuries, partial thickness chemical burns, full thickness electrical burns, traumatic amputations of the digits, osteomyelitis, venous stasis ulcerations, diabetic peripheral ulcerations, post-operative wounds, animal bite injuries, open fractures, traumatic wounds, and brown recluse spider bites. It's my deepest desire to share this technology with the world. Dr. A.B. Flick, M.D. Now, I can't vouch for Silverlawn. We bought some. I've got it here in my kit. I don't think that, well, I can tell you right now, I've never used it. Now, the wife might have used it. I didn't talk to her before I put this program together. That's the silver story. Personally, I'm going to use silver and charcoal rather than the conventional medical route. It's a choice that you have to make. If you research it out, I think you'll either come to one, the conclusion that government and the medical establishment can't help you in a pinch. They'll work just about like FEMA did with Hurricane Camille. Or, if they do, the results that you get will be problematic. For instance, 28% of people who receive inoculation, it may or may not help them, but it hasn't cured or prevented any flu, so says the National Institutes of Health. Which leads me to the conclusion, why in the hell would anybody want to have a vaccination if it doesn't prevent the disease? But they all admit that it doesn't. There hasn't been any documented cases of anyone being saved or prevented from getting the flu from the vaccine, but we all recommend it. Makes a lot of money for the vaccine companies, $5.4 million a year, but it makes such a small percentage, only 2% of their net revenue, they don't even want to make the stuff. And there's only 300 million doses that are made every year worldwide, and America needs all 300 million of them. What's that leave for the rest of the people in the world? And then on top of that, most of the vaccines are made outside the United States, and it's highly unlikely that the British or the French or the German governments are going to let those vaccine doses leave England, France, or Germany to come to the United States when their own populations need them, or at least they perceive that they need them. I think that relying upon vaccines and Tamiflu is going to be a sad experience. Just about like FEMA in New Orleans produced a sad experience. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard 7 days a week worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, economics, history, health, news, and current events 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. And a final reminder that the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember our website, georgegordon.org, or just call us direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we'll wrap this up with a little story here from the flu, the influenza pandemic of 1918. Here's the story of what happened past tense. Let's see if we can look at this and see, is this going to happen to us future tense? The influenza pandemic of 1918-1919 killed more people than the Great War, known today as World War I, at somewhere between 20 and 40 million people in the Western world. It has been cited as the most devastating epidemic in recorded world history. More people died of influenza in a single year than in all 4 years of the Black Death bubonic plague from 1347 to 1351. Known as the Spanish flu or La Gripe, the influenza of 1918-1919 was a global disaster. In the fall of 1918, the Great War in Europe was winding down and peace was on the horizon. The Americans had joined in the fight, bringing the Allies closer to victory against the Germans. Deep within the trenches, these men lived through some of the most brutal conditions of life, which it seemed could not be any worse. Then, in pockets across the world, something erupted that seemed as benign as the common cold. The influenza of that season, however, was far more than a mere common cold. In the 2 years that this scourge ravaged the earth, 1/5 of the world's population was infected. The flu was most deadly for people between ages of 20 and 40. This pattern of morbidity was unusual for influenza, which is usually a killer of the elderly and the very young. It infected 28% of all Americans, and an estimated 675,000 Americans died of influenza during the pandemic, 10 times as many as in the World War. Of the United States soldiers who died in Europe, half of them fell to influenza and not to the enemy. An estimated 43,000 servicemen mobilized for World War I died of the influenza flu. 1918 would go down as unforgettable as the year of suffering and death As noted in the Journal of the American Medical Association, final edition of 1918. They said, "The 1918 has gone, a year momentous as the termination of the most cruel war in the annals of the human race, a year which marked the end, at least for a time, of man's destruction of man. Now, unfortunately, a year in which developed a most fatal infectious disease, which caused the death of hundreds of thousands of human beings. Medical science, for 4.5 years, devoted itself to putting men on the firing line and keeping them there. Now, it must turn with its whole might to combating the greatest enemy of all, infectious disease," dated 12/28/1918. The effect of the influenza epidemic was so severe that the average lifespan in the United States was depressed by 10 years. The influenza virus had profound virulence with a mortality rate of 2.5% compared to the previous influenza epidemics, which were less than 0.1%. The death rate for 15 to 34-year-olds of influenza and pneumonia were 20 times higher in 1918 than in previous years. People were struck with illness on the street and died rapid deaths. One anecdote shared of 1918 was of four women playing bridge together late into the night. Overnight, three of the women died from influenza. Others told stories of people on their way to work suddenly developing the flu and dying within hours. And one physician writes that patients with seemingly ordinary influenza would rapidly develop the most vicious type of pneumonia that has ever been seen, the latter when cyanosis appeared in the patients. It is simply a struggle for air until they suffocate. Another physician recalls that the influenza patients died struggling to clear their airways of a blood-tinged froth that sometimes gushed from their nose and mouth. The physicians of the time were helpless against this powerful agent of influenza. In 1918, children would skip rope to the rhyme, "I had a little bird. Its name was Enza. I opened the window, and in flew Enza." The influenza pandemic circled the globe. Most of humanity felt the effects of this strain of the flu virus, and it spread following the path of its human carriers along trade routes and shipping lines. Outbreaks swept through North America, Europe, Asia, Africa, Brazil, and the South Pacific. In India, the mortality rate was extremely high, at around 50 deaths from influenza per 1,000 people. The Great War, with its mass movements of men, armies, and aboard ships, probably aided in its rapid diffusion and attack. The origins of the deadly flu disease were totally unknown, but widely speculated upon. Some of the Allies thought of the epidemic as a biological warfare tool of the Germans. Many thought that it was a result of the trench warfare, the use of mustard gas, and the generated smoke and fumes of the war. A national campaign began using the ready rhetoric of war to fight the new enemy of microscopic proportions. A study attempted to reason why the disease had been so devastating in certain localized regions. Looking at the climate, the weather, and the racial composition of cities, they found humidity to be linked with more severe epidemics as it fosters the dissemination of the bacteria. Meanwhile, the new sciences of the infectious agents and immunology were racing to come up with a vaccine or a therapy to stop the epidemic. The experiences of people in the military camps encountering the influenza pandemic, an excerpt for the memoirs of a survivor of Camp Funston of the pandemic survivor, a letter to a fellow physician describing conditions during the influenza epidemic at Camp Devens, and a collection of letters of a soldier stationed in Camp Funston. From a Camp Funston soldier. Now, the origins of this influenza variant is not precisely known. It is thought to have originated in China in a rare genetic shift of the influenza virus. The recombination of its surface proteins created a virus novel to almost everyone and a loss of herd immunity. Recently, the virus has been reconstructed from the tissue of a dead soldier and is now being genetically characterized. The name of Spanish flu came from the earlier affliction and large mortalities in Spain. It was in Spain where it allegedly killed 8 million people in May of 1918. However, a first wave of influenza appeared early in the spring of 1918 in Kansas and in military camps throughout the United States. Very few people noticed the epidemic in the midst of the war. Wilson had just given his 14-point address. There was virtually no response or acknowledgement to the epidemics in March and April in the military camps. It was unfortunate that no steps were taken to prepare for the usual recrudescence of the virulent influenza strain in the winter. The lack of action was later criticized when the epidemic could not be ignored in the winter of 1918. These first epidemics at training camps were a sign of what was coming in greater magnitude in the fall and winter of 1918 to the entire world. Now, the war brought the virus back into the United States for the second wave of the epidemic. It first arrived in Boston in September of 1918 through the port, busy with war shipments of machinery and supplies. The war also enabled the virus to spread and to diffuse. Men across the nation were mobilizing to join the military and the great cause of World War I. As they came together, they brought the virus with them and to those that they had contact with. The virus killed almost 200,000 people in October of 1918 alone. In November of 1918, the end of the war enabled a resurgence as people celebrated Armistice Day with parades and large parties, a complete disaster from a public health standpoint, a rebirth of the epidemic occurred in many cities across the nation. The flu that winter was beyond imagination, as millions of people were infected and thousands died, just as the war had affected the course of influenza. Influenza affected the course of the war. Entire fleets were ill with the disease, and men on the front were too sick to fight. The flu was devastating to both sides, killing more men than their own weapons could. With the military patients coming home from the war with battle wounds and mustard gas burns, hospital facilities and staff were taxed to the limit. This created a shortage of physicians, especially in the civilian sector, as many had been lost for service in the military in Europe. And since the medical practitioners were away with the troops, only the medical students were left to care for the sick here in the United States. Third and fourth year medical classes were closed, and the students were assigned jobs as interns or nurses. One article noted that the depletion has been carried to such an extent that the practitioners are brought very near the breaking point. The shortage was further confounded by the added loss of physicians to the epidemic itself. In the United States, the Red Cross had to recruit more volunteers to contribute to the new cause at home of fighting the influenza epidemic, to respond with the fullest utilization of nurses, volunteers, and medical supplies. The Red Cross created a national committee on influenza, and it was involved in both military and civilian sectors to mobilize all the forces available to fight the Spanish flu influenza outbreaks. And in some areas of the United States, the nursing shortage was so acute that the Red Cross had to ask local businesses to allow workers to have the day off if they volunteer in the hospitals at night. Emergency hospitals were created to take in the patients from the United States and those arriving sick from overseas. The pandemic affected everyone. With one quarter of the U.S. and one fifth of the world infected with the influenza, it was impossible to escape from the illness. Even President Woodrow Wilson suffered from the flu in early 1919 while negotiating the crucial Treaty of Versailles to end the World War. Those who were lucky enough to avoid infection had to deal with the public health ordinances to restrain the spread of the disease. The public health departments distributed gauze masks to be worn in public. Stores could not hold sales. Funerals were limited to 15 minutes. Some towns required a signed certificate to enter, and railroads would not accept passengers without these signed certificates. Those who ignored the flu ordinances had to pay steep fines enforced by extra officers. Bodies piled up as the massive deaths of the epidemic ensued. And besides the lack of health care, workers and medical supplies, there was a shortage of coffins, morticians, and grave diggers. And the conditions in 1918 were not so far removed from the Black Death in the era of the bubonic plague of the Middle Ages. But boys and girls, that's a report on what was going on in this country in 1918 and 1919 with the Spanish flu. So get ready for it, because if that happens again, you can expect the same kind of results. And you'll either take care of yourself or you won't get taken care of, because that was the experience that we had in 1918. I want to mention again Russell Harvey, who was an old man when I was a boy, told me about the flu, how he had to take care of his family. And it wasn't for just 3 or 4 days, it was for 3 weeks. Everybody that got this flu was sick, flat on their back for 3 weeks, with diarrhea, vomiting, blood coming out of their noses and mouths. And it was not only painful, excruciatingly sickening, but by taking care of those people, you almost ensured that you were going to get the flu. And indeed, Mr. Harvey told me that he did get the flu from his family, taking care of them. Fortunately, his wife had recovered enough that she could then take care of him. Now, once you've been through this, you develop immunity to it, natural immunity. I think you'd be better off if you could avoid getting the flu by simply using silver, charcoal, vitamins, minerals, clean foods, and a better diet. But then, you know, people don't take those kinds of actions before the fact. They wait until the event transpires, and then they try to recoup. Can I quit smoking now? Can I quit drinking now? Now that I'm sick, can I stop doing these things that cause the sickness and alleviate it? It's almost like a deathbed repentance. I'm not going to repent until I'm lying on my deathbed, and then I'm going to repent when it's probably too late. But that's the time that I need to repent, is when I'm about to die. Doesn't make any sense, but that's the way people behave. In 1918 and 1919, this deadly influenza pandemic erupted during the final stages of World War I. Nations were already attempting to deal with the effects and the costs of the war. Propaganda campaigns and war restrictions and rationing had been implemented by governments around the world. Nationalism pervaded as people accepted government authority. This allowed the public health departments to easily step in and to implement their restrictive measures. The war also gave science greater importance as governments relied on scientists, now armed with the new germ theory and the development of antiseptic surgery, to design vaccines and to reduce mortalities of disease and battle wounds. These new technologies could preserve the men on the front and ultimately save the world. These conditions created by World War I, together with the current social attitudes and ideas, led to the relatively calm response of the public and application of scientific ideas. People allowed for strict measures and loss of freedom during the war as they submitted to the needs of the nation ahead of their own personal needs. They had accepted the limitations placed with rationing and the military draft. The responses of the public health officials reflected the new allegiance to science and a wartime society. Now, the medical and scientific communities had developed new theories and applied them to prevention, diagnostics, and treatment of the influenza patients. Now, doesn't that sound precisely where we are today in 2005? Think about it. We're in the midst of war, the war on terror, being threatened now with an influenza outbreak. When the influenza outbreak takes place, and they promise us that it's going to, they talk about when, not if. It's not a report, it's propaganda. And when it does, don't you suppose that we're going to have masks, quarantine, and that we're going to have an authoritarian-type regime directing us and telling us when to come in, when to go out, and what to do in between? Mull it over. What happens in the past is cannon fodder for the future. You can just about bet on it. History repeats itself. Whether it's done intentionally or whether it's done by some unseen hand from somewhere, history repeats itself. What you saw happen in New Orleans will happen again. Hurricanes have been around for a long time, and they're getting worse, they're getting more frequent, and they're getting deadlier. They kill more people, and they destroy more property. So are the other disasters, like drought, and famine, and disease plagues, right along with earthquakes. Next time, we'll take a look at disasters, natural disasters, and what they portend for the future, and how they fit into Bible prophecy. All right, we're about out of time. Let me give you your final reminder. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Remember, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, there's the signal. Says our time's up. We'll have to leave it right there. I'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing. Thanks for listening, and good night, friends.